Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Brett Weinstein. He's a theoretical evolutionary biologist focused on evolutionary patterns within complex dynamic systems. His work revolves around trade-offs that force selection to balance competing values within fluctuating or patchy habitats. His current project is focused on human consciousness in the context of novel hazards and opportunities. He lives with his wife, children, and other animal affiliates in the Anthropocene. So, first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this discussion.
So, as much as I would love to discuss your evolutionary biology work with you, and I would love to do that in a different interview, today I would like to discuss an incident that occurred at Evergreen State College that leads to discussions of larger problems in academia and on the left. So can you fill people in on the background, and then we can start the meat of the discussion?
Yeah, for sure. Although I should say, there's the problem with the story is that it is tempting to try to encapsulate it in a very clean form, but the story actually goes back a full year before the event that caused it to erupt into the public consciousness. And I don't want to give short shrift to what actually took place, but I also don't want to go into lots of details that your listeners might not be interested in. So let me just suggest that if the short version of this doesn't satisfy, that your listeners would be well advised to look up a piece that came out in the Huffington Post on July 2nd by Michael Zimmerman about the implosion at Evergreen, in which he, being our former provost, goes into the deep story of how these events unfolded. So the events unfolded in a way that people began to see them when I was confronted by a group of what the protesters said was 50 people who decided to disrupt the program, which is Evergreen's version of a class that I was teaching. And they showed up at the building I was teaching, and a student in a group that I was overseeing alerted me to the fact that people were chanting outside the door hey, hey, ho, ho, Brett Weinstein's got to go, which was an unusual event. So I went to the door to ask them what was going on. And they seemed to know who I was. And anyway, I asked them if they wanted to discuss their concerns, and they said yes. And I said, well, how about we go to the fourth floor where there's none of my students are, so we can talk there without disrupting anything. And they said, where are your students now? I said, first three floors. And they said, then that's where we're going. They burst into the building and disrupted not just my program, but all of the work going on in the building, and confronted me asking, or insisting really, that I resign over what they perceived to be overt racism on my part. And what they were referring to in particular was an email that I had written to our faculty and staff email list, concerned about a change that had been made this year to a campus tradition. So the campus tradition is called Day of Absence, and it is coupled with Day of Presence. And Day of Absence traditionally has been an event in which students, faculty, and staff, initially black students, faculty, and staff, but in more recent years, all students, faculty, and staff of color have chosen to absent themselves from campus in an effort to highlight the vital roles that they play. This follows on a play called Day of Absence, written by Douglas Turner Ward, a black playwright, in the 60s, and this tradition at Evergreen started in the 70s. But this year, the organizing committee for Day of Absence decided that they wished to absent white people from the campus. And this set off alarm bells for me. And so I wrote a letter to the person who had announced this change, and I broadcast it to the faculty and staff, saying that there was a huge difference between a population absenting themselves in order to make a point and a population deciding to absent another population, and that I found this unacceptable. That email was picked up by our campus paper, which published it on the internet, and so anybody could access it. And then events must have unfolded behind closed doors, in which some group decided that this concern of mine was so egregious that it warranted my resignation or firing, and they decided to protest. They then went on to protest elsewhere in the college, and they posted videos of what they were doing on the internet, I think thinking that it would make them look powerful and insightful and noble to others looking on. And what happened, I think, is quite telling, which is that when the world saw these videos, overwhelmingly, outside of Evergreen at least, people were completely horrified by the behavior of the students. And then when they looked at my email, they were shocked to find that the racism that they had been told to expect simply wasn't there.
So can we add a couple details to this? My understanding is that at one point, I mean, can you talk about what you were told by the campus security?
Oh, sure. So the campus police were called while these protesters were disrupting my class and while I was trying to reason with them to not such great effect.
Wait. You know, there's another thing that really bugs me here before we even get any further, which is they could have confronted you at any time. And it seems to me that you were going out of your way to be kind to actually interrupt your class program, to discuss this with them. Because if I were teaching a class and somebody came up to talk to me, unless somebody is dying, I would say class finishes in another 43 minutes and we will talk at 10 minutes till the hour. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So since you were gracious in the first place to even interrupt class time.
Well, as luck would have it, and I think this is pure happenstance, I had my students broken into three groups discussing subtopics of our larger topic. And so at that point, I could have had a discussion with them while not disrupting the students' work. But, you know,
Nonetheless, they came to you during class.
Oh, say that again?
Nonetheless, they came to you during class.
Oh, they came to me during class, and it was clear that that was intentional.
Right.
I mean, in fact, they came to the building where I was teaching, which isn't anywhere near the building where my office is. So, their intent was to disrupt class and to do so in a dramatic form, and they succeeded in doing that. But I think they just clearly misjudged how the world would understand it. You've asked me though about the events that unfolded afterwards. So the campus police showed up as a result of somebody else having called them. It hadn't even really occurred to me to call them, but somebody else did. And they blocked the police. They actually, I think, stopped focusing on me, and they ran out into a sort of covered walkway space, and they blocked the police from coming in, which they would then complain, I think, erroneously, based on what shows up on the video, that the police had then brutally shoved white students out of the way in order to get to the students of color. But in any case, they blocked the police for some time. The police finally made their way into the building and contacted me. The protesters then moved on to the administration building and confronted administrators, including our relatively new president, Dr. Bridges. And they started making demands of him. They also posted video of those confrontations. And then one of the things that Bridges conceded to them was that there would be a meeting at 4 o'clock in an old cafeteria, no longer used for that purpose. It's now a large classroom space, but an old cafeteria on the fourth floor of the library building, that they could air their concerns there, and relevant administration and staff would be present. And I asked if I could be present, given that the protests seemed to focus at least in part on firing me. I felt I should be there to address it. And I went, and it was quite a frightening scene, actually. As I entered this fourth floor space, you have to go down a long corridor to get into the room. And as I walked down the corridor with a number of my students, so I should say the students who protested, none of them were my students. These were students I didn't know. And the students that I do know, both present and former students, have been overwhelmingly shocked at the allegations leveled against me because it doesn't match with the person they know. And so anyway, a number of them wanted to go with me to this meeting, I think feeling protective of me and feeling like they could speak to the issues in a way other people couldn't. And as we walked down the hallway, I was singled out and, you know, protesters started shouting that I was a white person in need of being followed. Basically, they assigned handlers to me to follow me into this room and to monitor my every move and report back. And maybe their purpose was to control me also. I don't know. But anyway, I went into this room and it was a bizarre scene where there were announcements made that the chairs were not to be used by white people, that they were for people of color, that there was food, which was also not to be used by white people. And there was a revision. Maybe there were enough chairs that white people could use them, but they should sit behind people of color. Anyway, the event unfolded, and this is all accessible on video for people who want to look it up, but the discussion was incredibly heated, and there were moments at which it appeared to nearly boil over into violence. People particularly shouting about me and the offensiveness of my presence at this meeting, or that it indicated something was deeply off. But anyway, there's a great deal of shouting, just, you know, at the top of one's lungs by protesters at the administrators and at me. I got text messages from friends elsewhere in the room telling me that protesters were discussing the fact that they had mace that they should keep under wraps and not let it be seen. There was also apparently discussion in a couple of places that I shouldn't be allowed to leave at the end of the meeting. So it was quite a frightening event. You know, there's one way in and out controlled by the protesters, anger at a level that one does not encounter it normally, and that anger was focused on, you know, a fiction, which is particularly dangerous because it's very hard to falsify a fiction that people have become so attached to that they won't even listen to dialogue about it. So anyway, I did manage to, I alerted an administrator that I was being told I might not be allowed to leave the room. I'm not sure exactly what he did. I was able to leave the room, at the end of this, this meeting. And the following day, Wednesday, I was not scheduled to have class. And so I did not come to campus, and I got a call, in the middle of the day. The police, actually it was the chief of police, called me and said, "Are you on campus?" And I said, "No." "Why?" And she said, "Well, we understand that protesters are searching car to car, and they're guarding the entrances to campus, and they say they're looking for an individual, and we think it's you." And they said, "Please don't come to campus. We don't think we can protect you." And I inquired why, and it turned out that as on in the latter part of Tuesday, the police had been told to stand down by the administration of the college, which is a very odd thing, especially in light of what was unfolding, to have the police told that they couldn't interact. And, you know, the police were, in fact, barricaded in the police station, meant that the protesters had effectively gained control of the campus, and that the campus was essentially being governed by an anarchic mob at that point. The following day, I did have class scheduled. I contacted my students and I said, "Oh, by the way, I should tell you, my students at this point were being followed in the woods. They were being harassed and they were being doxxed, meaning that they were having their information distributed online. This is all now documented. The protesters, in fact, discussed that they were doing these things and then discussed that they needed to stop at some point when it became a public relations problem for them. But on Thursday, I told my students by email that it wasn't safe for us to return to campus and that we should meet downtown. And I got on my bike to go meet them. And as I passed the entrance that I usually take to campus, I saw people that I thought I recognized from the protest grab their cell phones. And I thought, this can't be happening. And so I rode around the corner and I diverted my my journey, and I went to the police station, and I knocked on the door. The police were locked inside, and I talked to the chief again, and I said, I've got to be imagining this. And she said, I don't think you are imagining this. You're not safe on your bike. I can't protect you. I want you to go home, put your bike away, and take the car to go meet your students. So there's more, but let's just say those vignettes, just the experience of appearing to be hunted on one's own campus, having the police hobbled in their attempt to do to restore some kind of rule of law to the campus, was a surreal experience.
So I want to read one sentence from the article that you mentioned earlier, the Evergreen State College Implosion, Are There Lessons to Be Learned?
Sure.
Which is, quote, because you have not yet mentioned the baseball bats. So I just want to mention that. The response made by the vice president for student affairs when student protesters were roaming the campus armed with baseball bats and tasers made it clear that differences of opinion could be frightening. And for me, at least, this gets to the heart of much of this. That, I mean, just to be clear, so everybody listening to this knows, we have students armed with baseball bats and tasers roaming the campus. This is correct, right?
Absolutely correct. And not only that, there is at least one incident in which somebody was hit with a baseball bat. It was documented. I think it was a very low light situation, and so the documentation doesn't entirely, you know, you don't see very much that you can recognize, but actually the audio that goes with it is absolutely frightening. So somebody was challenged by a group with baseball bats, and then effectively the group of people who were challenged, and then one of them was hit, ended up making it to one of our dormitories, and they were challenged again, an attempt to get the cell phone that had captured this event from them so that the protesters could do away with the evidence that it had occurred. So there's nothing speculative about what happened, and there's nothing symbolic about these folks wandering with their baseball bats. They were behaving as enforcers of a code that only they know, where their judgment, I mean, I can't even believe we're talking about their judgment. Maybe it doesn't even make sense to mention it, but to have people whose understanding of what is taking place is as far off as the protesters' understanding appears to be, to have control of the campus effectively ceded to them by the administration over the strong safety objections of the police is almost unfathomable.
So let's just be explicit that, and then let's move to the larger. I mean, as horrifying as this is personally, I think both you and I are mainly want to focus on the larger implications for society. And
absolutely,
I mean that in no disrespect to your own personal safety. I would be terrified.
The larger issues are more important to me as well.
They always are.
Right. Yeah.
But before we go on, I just want to explicitly acknowledge that we have a university professor, your professor, right? Full professor? Yep.
Exactly. Well, we have a different system at our college, but I have the highest rank that we've got here. So yeah.
So essentially a university professor at a university for whom the campus police are saying we cannot guarantee your safety from mobs of students. And even forgetting the actual content of the actual subject, just the notion that, I mean, okay, when I was in college, one day Edward Teller came to speak at the Colorado School of Mines where I got my degree. Edward Teller is one of the most horrible human beings of the 20th century. And there was no notion that students with baseball bats were going to assault this guy who had suggested that you drop a hydrogen bomb to make a bay in Alaska. And universities, there's this concept that universities were supposed to be this bastion of free speech. And even forgetting, once again, I agree with you. I've read your email. I think it's all, I agree with you all down the line. This is all fine. But even ignoring all that, even if your perspective was problematical on some level.
Even if I was a flat out unapologetic racist, having students roving with baseball bats makes no sense.
Yes, and you and I could both list any number of professors who have said things that actually are quite objectionable.
Sure.
Or for crying out loud, Lawrence Summers, you know, with his whole thing about certain countries being underpolluted and also his thing about how women aren't in science because their brains don't work that way. I mean, and his response, the response to him was that he was made Secretary of the Treasury.
Right. I mean, and you know, my guess is we'll agree on this too. The best thing to do in the case that somebody has an indefensible perspective is to let them voice it.
And then you just, I'm going to say the word slam, but I'm going to add the word rhetorically. You slam them rhetorically. You
right.
let them speak, and then you show how ridiculous their perspective is. This is the whole point of, sorry that my voice is getting thin and reedy, but this makes me so mad, that this is the whole point of college, that in a well-administered college that was well, that was within a context, I don't want to blame Evergreen, because this is happening all over the country in different ways, and the problem with the left, too, I want to get to. But what this should be, this is what happened. Okay, Edward Teller came to the Colorado School of Mines. He's odious. One of my few days I specifically remember 35 years later about college was the discussion we had in my English class the next day with students arguing vociferously, he's horrible, no, I like him, and the teacher saying, you can't just say he's a horrible human being, you have to defend your position. And
yep.
the teacher used it as an opportunity to teach us how to think.
Well, unfortunately, I think what we are witnessing, and, you know, Evergreen, I have little doubt, is ahead of the curve on this. But what we are witnessing is the breakdown of the most fundamental alignment that allows something like a university to function. That we are now in disagreement about the basic purpose of the institution. And so what was clearly true at Evergreen is that the protesters, and then maybe most surprisingly, the administration and the faculty demonstrated themselves not only to be deeply in error about what was going on, but to be effectively ineducable. That even the revelation that what they were saying was horrifying to people across the political spectrum, even in light of that, there was no ability to update their model and rethink the situation. What they've done is effectively doubled down on the initial interpretation, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, at some point, you would think there would be enough evidence that they had something wrong that it would cause soul-searching, but I have not seen that soul-searching yet.
So let's be explicit. I'm just going to ask you, what are the larger social implications, what are the larger implications for this discussion? What insights does this whole incident give us into problems within both academia and the left?
Yeah, that is a good question that we'll, we can maybe start that discussion here. But I think the first one has to do with, I don't think I'm overstating the case to say the death of inquiry. That in effect, what is being asserted in this protest at Evergreen and the larger movement that it represents, what is being asserted is that actually we've got the answer and anything that conflicts with it does so for illegitimate reasons. And so, you know, throughout the year that led up to this protest, there was increasing animosity and increasingly overt animosity toward the sciences in particular. And in fact, the vandalism that took place during the protest appeared to be targeted at the sciences in particular. And this is a frightening fact because a society that cannot ask a question that it doesn't know the answer to, that has to start with the answers and work backwards, you know, essentially rationalizing those answers with something that looks like inquiry but isn't, is a dangerous society. It leaves us no tools with which to navigate important issues, including issues of race and including the treatment that people experience in society and whether or not it is fair. So inquiry is the best tool we've got, and science, to my way of thinking, is the greatest bullshit detector that has ever been devised. So to hobble it in favor of answers that we think we know, and then to just hard code those answers in as if they're true and don't need to be scrutinized, is an appalling thing to happen anywhere. For it to happen at colleges and universities tells us that we are headed somewhere very dangerous as a society, because those institutions effectively have a kind of intellectual custody of the minds that go on to navigate for civilization. So to the extent that we are going to avoid pitfalls, we need inquiry to be more vital now than it's been, rather than to be hobbled by an overly simplistic notion of what ought to be. So then you asked about the left.
Sorry, go ahead.
I think that's really just an extension of the same puzzle. I am totally shocked at the complete collapse of the left. And I have the sense, even though you and I probably disagree on some details, I think based on what I've read of your work, I would imagine that you and I agree that we're very much on the wrong track, that there are basic fundamental principles about which all reasonable people would agree, and that we should be attempting to figure out how to protect those principles in the face of all threats, you know, including sustainability and fairness and those kinds of things. And, you know, these things are a focus of the left, or at least traditionally they have been. But at the moment, the left is, to the extent that it exists at all, obsessed with trivia and easy answers, and has become frightened of its own shadow when it comes to actually discovering new truths that it doesn't know. It's become the caricature that the right often paints of it, which for those of us who are still out here on the left is strangely, profoundly isolating. And that's a problem that I think we need to solve right away. And to the extent that I've seen a lot from people on the right since this event has unfolded, since the story at Evergreen in some sense reinforces some of the beliefs on the right has been quicker to embrace it and grapple with it. And there is this thread, it's not everybody on the right, but some fraction of the right wishes to see this as a total vindication of their perspective on everything, which it very definitely isn't. But to the extent that the right is crowing about the collapse of the left, it is doing itself no favor. That a vibrant right, to the extent that that's possible, actually requires a vibrant left. And the collapse of the left is a disaster across the spectrum. I'm quite convinced of that.
That, I think that's really interesting. And before we go any further, I want to just make clear too that while I loved what you said about Evergreen being ahead of the curve, but I want to be really clear that these are problems that are nationwide, although Evergreen, once again, may be two steps ahead of many other places.
Yeah.
And that there are attempts to... I wrote an essay about this a couple years ago because I'd been deplatformed at a couple universities. And it cracked me up in some ways because for years, I mean, you know my work, and I've been advocating for people to take out dams. I've been advocating for people to bring down civilization. And that never got me deplatformed. The right never deplatformed me. It was the left that deplatformed me.
Yeah.
And so I started doing research on this, and, you know, the sort of pro-Israel forces are still deplatforming a lot of people. But in general, the left has really taken over the mantle of deplatforming. Or for crying out loud, we all know about the riots at Berkeley when they were going to have, Ann Coulter. And of course, Ann Coulter is just, her perspective is really bad. But it's just, the irony seemed to be lost that at the, you know, the birthplace of the free speech movement, they were rioting to prevent somebody from speaking.
Yeah, it's a,
so this is a problem. My point is, this is not an isolated incident.
No, it's a symptom, I think, of the equivalent. This is like the intellectual equivalent of an autoimmune disorder, where we are now, I don't want to say we, because it's not some of us, but some on the left in particular are sabotaging the tools that are most necessary for us to navigate. And, you know, you saw a talk by Edward Teller. I remember one in college by Louis Farrakhan, you know, who was well understood to be anti-Semitic and unapologetically so. But I went to his talk and I listened. And you know, you and I are talking here. We have a tremendous agreement, I would imagine, over the fundamental importance of sustainability. I think we have disagreement over whether or not civilization could be made sustainable. And you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about how it might be. And I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about what civilization is and what might come next. We don't agree, but there's no difficulty with us navigating the territory that is opened by the questions of two people who've navigated honestly and come to conclusions that aren't the same. In fact, it's the most fertile ground there is for discovery. So it does seem to me that deplatforming, the very idea that there are concepts that are so frightening that one must not hear them is on its face absurd.
Especially at a university.
Especially at a university. If there's one place that doesn't need to be true, it's, you know, the university is effectively like what, you know, programmers would call a sandbox. It's a place where it is safe to try out ideas and see how far they go, to investigate phenomena to see what they are, because nothing is riding on the outcome of the inquiry. You can do the inquiry honestly because the inquiry is not plugged into the apparatus of what keeps things running. And, you know, the purpose, of course, is to, or at least hopefully, is to understand how things work in a better way, to open opportunities that we haven't spotted yet, or to improve what we're doing so it's less destructive and more rewarding. But the idea that you need a space in which you are liberated to think freely, which means to engage with bad ideas and discover why they're bad and how bad they are, that's fundamental. And to
promote them until you figure out they're bad. I mean, God knows I've done that.
Exactly. I mean, every intellectual honest broker has done that. It's fundamental to being such a person.
My favorite example of this is Lewis Mumford. Lewis Mumford was absolutely pro-technology. He wrote several books pro-technology until World War II. And he's like, oh, I get it. And after that, he wrote books that undercut the thesis he'd been promoting for 10 years.
Anyway, yes, sorry, in fact, I think one of the things that has gone wrong inside the university system is, and I credit this to the influence that markets have had on the intellectual environment. But it has become possible to get ahead in the university system by being wrong in a particular way. And that shouldn't be the case. If you want science and the university system where it lives to discover new things and to actually improve the resolution with which we understand the universe that we live in, you need to align things so that at the point that it becomes clear that you are incorrect, as painful as it is to get to the right side of the issue, your interests have to be mirrored in your getting there as quickly as possible. We do not want a system that pays people to stay on the wrong side of an issue and to cover, because that just blinds us. So we, you know, for the same reason you don't want your friends to rationalize because it's dangerous to your partnership, You don't want your university system to foster rationalization amongst scientists, because it blinds you to what's true that you need to know, which may not be very pleasant, but that's the way it is.
So there's kind of a philosophical elephant in the room that we haven't named as such so far. And that's, can you talk for a moment? We have about 11 or 12 minutes left. Can you talk for a moment about postmodernism and the conflict? I think that postmodernism is one of the things that has destroyed the left. And can you talk for a moment about postmodernism versus science, or just take it anywhere you want?
Sure. Yeah, I agree with you. It has a very important role to play, in this story. And in fact, I think.
Can you define it for people too, please? I'm sorry.
Sure. And I'm probably not going to do it justice. There is an intellectual tradition that results in what we now call postmodernism that is not, it's very easy to caricature it. And I don't want to do that. I think in the end, it's been a disaster, but it's unfair to portray every point it's ever made as incorrect. In fact, I think it proceeds from a correct observation, which is that perception is unavoidably at the interface between what we understand to be true and what is true. And so that the fact that we cannot completely prune perception out from between us and the universe that we're trying to understand creates real problems. Now, of course, the best tool for addressing that is really high quality science that can tell you when your expectations about nature are incorrect. But in any case,
the place we disagree, I should get my baseball bat. Sorry,
well,
go ahead.
Let's put it this way. I encountered postmodernism first when I was in college, at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And at the time it was obvious, even on a brief encounter with it, that it was a kind of intellectual nihilism that is motivated to interfere with high quality thinking. So it's kind of a weaponized analytical perspective. What it means is, or what it has been, what it has come to mean, is that the flaws and the hazards in discovering what is true are understood to be so fundamental that the truth itself becomes suspect. And taken to its logical extreme, this means that effectively all truth is in some sense a social construction. And therefore, to the extent that the truth may say things that are problematic or distasteful, that's really the result in general of somebody's oppressive ideology, that truth is in fact a weapon of oppression, is where this has ended up. And so you can imagine people who have such a perspective deciding that listening to the arguments made by those who hold these perspectives would be a mistake, and this is where this instinct to deplatform comes from. If arguments that are phrased analytically are inherently political arguments about preserving and acquiring power for those who have control enough to dictate, you know, how science functions or something like that, then simply denying them the opportunity, interfering with the conduct of their work, seems logical. And the problem is, this was for decades effectively, you know, much more active in the university system than you would hope, but it was corralled to certain fields where it was understood to be high quality work. And the fields that understood it to be an abomination were insulated from it by the fact that it had no right to dictate, or very little right to dictate, whether science got done.
And what we're seeing, an example of that real quick might be that, you know, lit crit, a lot of this crap has emerged from literary criticism, that in lit crit all you have is a text. So obviously there's lots of interpretations, et cetera, et cetera. So as long as it stays in the lit crit area, it's like they can do whatever they want. But as soon as they start trying to say that this means that we can't absolutely say that if you drop a ball off of a overpass, it's going to land and hit the highway, then that's where it becomes complete bunk.
Well, beyond bunk, it becomes a, it becomes like a shotgun or, you know, an Uzi where it indiscriminately, takes out structures that are vital and important. So what happened at Evergreen, I think, is that the incorrect, abstractions of postmodernism became militant and they started to go after the structures of science. I mean, very directly. And they started to argue effectively that science was itself racist, that, it was a place that students should avoid so that they were not, polluted by the propagation of those racist ideas. And if you extrapolate from this, it's very, very dangerous to me. And I think in some sense, why I ran afoul of this thing more than some of my colleagues is that I actually do teach about race. I teach about it evolutionarily and I'm not shy about talking about how this came about and what the relationship of racism is to our understanding of genetics and all of that. So in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of almost every student I've had, that discussion is empowering and it doesn't really matter what race you come from. It's empowering and maybe it's even more vital if you're a student of color, having a rigorous understanding of race and history and the way those things have interfaced is very powerful. So, you know, if you ask me what we should do about the fact that, that civilization is unfair and in a racially biased way, well, we should arm students with a scientific toolkit for understanding how that works, why it happens, and what strategies that would be robust in the face of that might be. And then imagine that the other side believes actually the solution to this is to run away from science and to cover the ears of those who might hear this and find it like the siren song. Those two things are just incompatible.
Go ahead.
I think I was there.
Well, part of the problem for me, and this is one of the best explications of postmodernism I've heard. Thank you. And part of the problem for me is that, if you have deemed that there is no such thing as truth and that there, that facts themselves don't objectively exist, then basically all you're left with are rhetorical tools. And all you're left with then, if someone throws a fact at you, but you don't believe in facts, all you can do basically is try to get them to shut up either by calling them a bigot or by hitting them with a baseball bat. I mean, that's really what it, what postmodernism comes down to, that, that if you and I, okay, you and I are going to, and we're not going to play this out, but you and I have a disagreement about whether civilization can ever be sustainable. So I say to you, okay, fact A, 10,000 years ago, fact B, this, fact C, this. And you say, okay, I disagree with fact C, I agree with facts A and B, here's how I explain those, and by the way, here's our facts D, E, and F that show my position. And then you and I sort of battle it out with facts. Am I right so far?
Yep.
But if you don't believe in facts, if I say, okay, points A, B, and C, and if you're going to disbelieve that facts themselves can convince, then all you're left with is doing, is like asserting things, which doesn't really count. All you can do is then either call me names or hit me or, you know, I don't know, do something else rhetorically. Do you see what I'm saying? But you can't, the whole point here of having a discussion. So you and I are going to go to dinner and I show up 20 minutes late and you say to me, Derek, why are you 20 minutes late? And I say, I wasn't late. What do we do with that? Do you see what I'm trying to get at with this?
Oh, 100%. And you know, this does lead to the, I think the hardest point to extract from this whole story. So not only do you get a kind of arbitrary interaction with facts, but you get a kind of the right to weaponize language and logic. And then, you know, if you look at what happened at Evergreen, the number of places where you can find the protesters on tape or on video discussing their narrative of events and then the videos that they produced, which contradict their representation of those events, you can see the failure of postmodern thinking, because the video, whether they like it or not, captures some version of what actually took place. And yes, it's biased by what perspective the camera was standing in, but it doesn't put words in people's mouths. So I think the irony of the Evergreen story that I really hope people will start thinking about is that this was a place in which people who were fully convinced of a postmodern worldview were given or took the power to operationalize that worldview. And we saw what happened. We saw what a terrible job it did dealing with basic facts like who said what or who did what. We saw what it did to policing. So it represented itself as capable of taking over for the police, and it demanded, it became obsessed with driving the police off campus on the basis of claims of brutality that it can't back up. And then it roved the campus with bats and it hit people and attempted to get their phones back in order to, or get their phones away from them in order to do away with facts it found inconvenient. So I think the story of Evergreen is really what happens when you take these crazy ideas about how the universe works out of the realm of the abstract and you operationalize them. And for some reason at Evergreen, the administration and a large fraction of the faculty were willing to go along with the experiment. But I hope people understand the result of that experiment, because for the rest of the university system and for the left itself, it's very much a cautionary tale.
Well, that seems like a perfect place to end, and we can either end there, or if there's like one or two minutes left if you want them, or we're great. Is there anything else you want to say about this situation?
I don't think so. I think that actually covers it as well as anything. I hope at some point we get to pick up the conversation and talk about evolutionary theory and what its implications are for civilization and maybe for revitalizing the left.
That sounds absolutely great. And thank you so much for the conversation today. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Brett Weinstein. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.